Welcome back to the 343 Sparkcast. I'm getting a sense of deja vu. 1 year later, we're here at San Diego Comic-Con, which is where we recorded the first episode last year. We have a change of cast slightly from last year, but should be no less interesting. We're obviously here down in San Diego for the Comic-Con. We're recording this on Saturday. Yesterday, we did the Halo Universe panel. I want to introduce the folks joining me today. As usual, we have Frank O'Connor, Franchise Development Director of 343.
Howdy.
And our special guest today is Karen Travis, author of the upcoming novel Glasslands.
Morning.
Karen, it is, isn't it?
It's still morning, but you look very relaxed. You're lounging in your chair. You have a coffee sitting back. It's not too bad for Comic-Con. It's much better than walking around the show floor, I think.
Oh, yes, yeah. This is much more peaceful. You don't get the feeling that you're a salmon swimming upstream, you know, to spawn and die at the end of the hall.
How many Comic-Cons have you made it to, Karen?
I think this is my sixth or seventh.
This is only my second. Last year was my first. So I've been to a lot of conventions, but even I was taken aback by how crazy it is here. But want to talk about Halo Glasslands and everything. We talked about it a little bit yesterday on the panel. I was fortunate enough, the gentleman passed me along the latest copy of it. I was able to read it on the plane right down here. I have to say I was really surprised by the book a little bit. I mean, we'd seen like little press briefings on they've been described, and obviously some of the characters you're dealing with is picking up some of the strings that were left out there from Ghost of Onyx, but I was surprised by how much bigger the story is and how much broader that is. It's not just the characters there on Onyx, that's a part of the story, but you very quickly open the universe wide open to talk about kind of the remnants of this post-Covenant human war and kind of picking up the pieces and figuring out how the universe brings itself back together. As an author, what were some of the challenges of kind of continuing this story?
Well, I always tend to specialize in the ordinary person doing extraordinary things. And the one thing you can't say about Spartans is that they're ordinary. And I wanted to move away really from the Spartan thing because it's been covered fully. And I always like to say, what happened to all the other thousands of troops? What happened to all these other people who were out there fighting the war? And if you look at the political situation, when peace breaks out, it's actually a much more dangerous time because it's all fragmented. I mean, we've seen it ourselves in the last 20 years, that the nice tidy lines of us and them from the Cold War just disintegrated, and you've got incredibly varied threats. And, you know, you can imagine somebody like the Office of Naval Intelligence thinking, aha, this is a very handy time for us. You know, this is not a conventional war. And I think one of the things that I wanted to do, although I specialise in these small elite unit type things, you know, the commando type stories, I suddenly thought this was an area I really wanted to look at. I wanted to know what the intelligence people were doing because, you know, you're talking about spooks with their own navy, effectively. They're a navy within a navy, and that's well scary. That's really scary. They've got weapons. You can't even say that about some of the real intelligence services. They've got warships. They've got nukes. You know, spies with nukes is really quite frightening. And I thought, well, what would I do if I were them? Faced with this political situation, I would want to go in and basically make sure that my enemies did not regroup. And that's really the whole premise of it. And inevitably, at the end of wars, that's when everyone suddenly discovers their conscience and all the things that were expedient during wars at a political level. Then suddenly people start asking questions and go, no, it wasn't me, it was him who did it. And everyone's covering their backside frantically. So I'm sort of thinking, I started thinking in terms of a black ops team made up of a fairly motley crew willing to do very strange things. All my stuff, all my books, all my comics, everything I do is about the politics of identity, who you are, who you're loyal to. And loyalty is tested at times like that. You know, you're asked to do some dodgy things. You're not sure that the people who have been on your side are necessarily on your side now. And you get a very murky situation, and then people will tend to trust a very small circle. At the same time, we've still had this looming thing about what happens with Onyx, because Halsey's there. And I think it's no secret now that there's a sort of really warped sort of psychology to the woman that fascinated me, because she really is Dr. Mengele. And the way I write characters is to get inside their heads. I don't do plot first. It's always, okay, let's choose the characters, let's work out what their, you know, build their psychological profiles and then put them in this environment and say, what would they do next and what would that character do to that one? And then work through the story in the, through their eyes. And I don't think I'm giving away too much if I say that I've got Halsey as a point of view character. And that was a scary head to be in. And
no, it's not a place you want to spend
No. I mean, you often hear cops, it's almost a cliche. People who work with serial killers and people like that say you don't want to be inside their heads. If you really want to think like a character, nobody who's evil from the outside sits there thinking, I'm evil, twiddling their moustache, you know. Nobody does that. The worst serial killer in the world thinks they're normal, and she thinks she's justified in what she's done. But it's how she internally justifies herself that's really quite painful. And you come out of it and shake your head and think, now I'd like to get into a normal head now for a few months.
Not only do they think they're normal, they think everyone else is broken. And they're trying to fix all the problems
absolutely.
With everyone else.
Absolutely. And her, especially because she has this sort of sense of being able to do anything, that the rules don't apply to her. Rules are for little people.
Yeah. I actually thought it was interesting. We were talking a little bit before we went on mic about the concept of, you brought up the sense of conscience getting the best of you at the end of a war and everything like that. And obviously Halsey has committed just atrocious acts, you know, war crimes in essence, but there are no war crimes when you're the winner.
Absolutely, and this is the point some of the characters make, and the reason I'm hesitating, I think, how much shall I say at this stage? I don't think there's any harm in telling people who the main characters are. In terms of the Black Ops team, we've got two ODSTs, Mal and Vaz, and they're just ordinary Marines, they're ordinary guys, but they've been picked. They're not entirely sure why they've been picked out of this entire pool that could have been chosen to do this job. But they are very resourceful. They're very ordinary, and they've got their own strong moral compass. They've also got an ONI captain who's heading up the mission. Fairly soon, they find out where she came from, and she does not have happy memories of Halsey. She's one of her failures. So she's not sending postcards home to mum saying, oh, mum, I miss you. You know, she's got issues. We've got the wonderful Margaret Parangoski, who I just saw the mention of this. I thought, you've got a 92-year-old admiral heading up this really fearsome organisation that everybody's scared of. You know, that can make people disappear. And there was just one line that, you know, that Halsey was the only person to have crossed her and lived. And I thought, that's what I'm going to take, and I'm going to retwist that. So who is Margaret Parangoski? I just explored her. And she is scary. She is magnificently scary, but she has this soft spot for the captain who's called Serin Osman, who may or may not be of Turkish background. We don't know. And it's just fascinating to watch where she draws the line between snuffing out people's existence without a second thought if it threatens the state or threatens the UNSC, but being very, very protective of this failed Spartan, who's almost a sort of granddaughter figure to her, and she's grooming her to take over.
And she sort of dotes on her. I mean, she'll send her gifts, candies, things like that, letting her know that she's thinking about her and that she cares about her.
Yeah. And she's also given her this wonderful tool. Well, tool isn't the word. This wonderful bodyguard come spy, the AI known as BB Black Box, because I do like my AIs, and he was fun. He came to me while I was crossing the road. I was lucky I didn't get hit by a truck, because the idea struck me as I was crossing, and there's quite a lot of traffic on that road, and I just thought, I want an AI in this. And I thought of all the AIs that I'd done. I'd written a Cortana thing, and I looked at the other AIs, and they're all very people based. And I thought, if I were an AI, and I was really proud of what I was, I wouldn't want to be a human. I would just want to be a box, a black box, this mysterious thing that lesser people cannot look in and see the contents of. And, you know. So Black Box, or BB as he prefers to be called, he just regards having arms and legs like Cortana as being a bit needy, a bit sad.
You were talking about a little bit, Frank, before we went on, is that in some ways you kind of see him as the anti-Cortana.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. For one thing, he wasn't sort of not very human in his origin. But also, he, as Kieran just said,
thinks about the sort of affectations and the visual affectations that AIs sort of impose upon themselves is kind of irrelevant and pointless. Like, he's an intellect, and that's what he is. And if it has a shape, as far as he's concerned, it might as well be simple. And he does have an ego, though. I mean, the fact that he's Black Fox is deliberately designed to put people on edge and keep them off balance. Whereas Cortana very much is curious about humanity and being a human. And she's ultimately birthed from humanity, and so she's a very different creature. And BB does not care about that stuff at all, but he does like being in control, and he has a very innate sense of superiority and an absolute ego, but in a very different way than the other AIs we've encountered.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, when I thought him up, I don't see him as putting barriers up. He's just saying, this is what I am, take it or leave it. He's so comfortable with himself, and that is ego.
But that in itself contains vanity.
Oh, right? He's like, enormously vain.
Because
he's enormously vain.
Human terms, he doesn't even have to be a fox. That was ultimately a decision he made. And there's some vanity in that.
Yes,
he knows that it discomforts people.
Yes,
or at least makes them curious. But it certainly puts them on their heels.
And he's also massively vain with language. This is a creature that can think in binary impulses. Yeah. And yet he enjoys this incredibly over-the-top sort of...
He's quite judgmental, too. I mean, he doesn't do anything with his judgments of the people around him other than sort of, like, reflect on them internally, but he's quite judgmental.
Oh, yes. I mean, he certainly looks down on the other AIs, and he's got his own dirty tricks program running back. Yeah, he loves splitting himself off and looking at all the dirty tricks he's playing on everybody. But
at the same time, you mentioned that his reactions to other AIs, but even just humans, he likes... just moving himself around because he can go anywhere on the ship and be anywhere. Just in mid-sentence, moving behind them just to throw them off, just to kind of test and see how they react to it, always, every time. Just wants to know how everyone's going to react every time. He needs to know everything. Like, it's ultimately...
Yeah, I'm not... It's interesting you interpret it that way because when I'm writing him, that's not why he's doing it. He doesn't have to manifest at all, but he knows that it freaks them out until they get used to him. So he tries to show himself... And he tries to stand in front of them so they can see him. And when he meets Saren Osman for the first time, she walks through the hologram. And he's really quite offended by that because humans normally walk around. You know, you don't just barge straight through me. And she's like, you know, she's very wary of him until she knows this is the AI that's been given to her. And will defend her come what may. And she warms to him. And... you know, the whole thing's about loyalty is that Parangovsky believes in loyalty. If you're loyal, that's more important than being competent in a lot of ways. You've got to know who you can trust. And she said, you can trust him with your life. Will I need to? She says, oh, yes.
You know, that reminded me, there's a cultural anthropologist in this book who is very, very, very human, necessarily so, yes. So it contrasts with the elites. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Oh, yeah. I mean... Whenever I come up with characters, they're often... I start out and say, what's the environment and what sort of people would be there? And I suddenly thought, well, they would really need someone who was an academic and a linguist. And I thought it was quite funny that it starts out... They actually need someone to broker the deals with the Sangeli, who have fractured, basically. There are all sorts of sects and rifts and factions and infighting, and they find one... that they want to basically stoke up the war with, keep them off balance, keep them fragmented, stop them from rearming, and they get they get this guy called Evan Phillips who is a professor to actually go in and do the talking, and it's enormously brave because he isn't a very big guy compared to the soldiers he's working with. Certainly, this 9-foot-tall elite in front of him, and he's just talking to him and perfectly happy. Because he's fascinated. This is a big break for him. It's quite interesting that he looks naive to start with, and then Saren Osman starts to realise he's actually very devious because he's come from the academic world where the internal politics is dirty.
And that's actually one of the things I really appreciated about that character specifically. So often in literature, academics are seen as these idealists. This is a guy, he's been in the real world. He knows how it works.
He actually wants his research papers. He wants to get his tenure sorted out. You know, I mean... This is the real academic world, you know. People don't get stabbed with real knives, but they get stabbed nonetheless.
All the pieces with Phillips, though, they have this really interesting judo perspective where you want to find out more about the elites because they're incredibly alien to your culture, but it's all kind of told from the elite's perspective, where there's this little funny alien in their midst, and he's the alien. And it's his interaction. He has a very particular skill that the elites are incredibly fascinated by. They've never encountered a human quite as unique as this one anyway. And he's already kind of world famous by the end of the book on Sangelios. But it's funny that a lot of the way that he's defined is actually the elite's reactions to this funny little man, his really strange skill set, and the fact that he speaks fluent, very fluent Sangeli, but like, as they point out, but exactly like a well-spoken child, really.
Well, so, they almost regard him as an idiot child. I mean, this is why he gets away with it, because he's sort of so weak and so far below them in status that harming him would be cowardly and you know, it'd be like hitting a kid. But one of the saints, Angeli, says, you know, he's probably shocked that he can talk, even though he talks like an idiot child, best culled for his own.
But he does have some of the academic tropes. You know, he is like a kid in a candy store. He's like Howard Carter sent back to ancient Egypt and getting to meet Cleopatra, right? And he's wandering around, like, touching things, poking things, and looking at things. And he actually, as a part of the kind of diplomatic mission, gets really deep access into their parts of their culture that they don't think are necessarily important, so they're not a threat to them, but there's just this genuine sort of surprise as you go with him on this tour of elite culture.
Karen, you mentioned kids and obviously family. I thought it was actually interesting that for really the first significant time outside of like Halo Legends, we've dealt with the female members of the elite.
I actually
thought that was interesting in the way their characters are portrayed in the book. Can you talk a little bit about how their characterization came about?
Yes. When you sort of look at a society, and obviously for gaming purposes, you have your various species and they do certain things, and you never see, obviously you haven't got the time and you don't have a need to get into their society. But when you're writing a novel, you clearly need to flesh that out enormously. And I just think, what happens on this planet? What does everyone else do? If you're not a male of fighting age, who provides the food? What happens? And there's this whole sort of, if people could see that the work I did on a novel initially, I found it very boring, because a lot of it is working out the economics of the planet, about where the food supply comes from, what happens when that trade route's cut off. And this is a species that's been reliant on the profits. Everything's been provided for them. You just go and fight. You know, this is your role. You'll get fed. You'll get the technology supplied, and that's actually made them very weak. They've just become cannon fodder, and they suddenly realise this. But then they can fall back on their own culture. I think, well, what is their own culture? We don't see much of the females before, so I think, okay, I'm not going to suddenly reinvent a whole new backstory where the females are fighting as well, because that changes essentially what Halo is. It's very much the males as a sort of visible part of that culture. So what are the women doing? They are back at the keeps. They rule there. And I was fascinated by the fact that Sangeli kids can't know who their fathers are. Now, that immediately gives you a whole springboard for how that whole thing works. Now, clearly, someone's got to control the bloodlines. You know, otherwise, you're going to have genetic problems. So that's where the females have the power. You know, they basically choose the mates. They basically decide who's with who. And their word is law. And, you know, the males have the domain outside the house, but inside the females rule. And one of the Sangeli characters, you know, we actually get to meet his wife, and she's very dismissive of all these former warriors wandering around. She's saying, well, you know, you haven't got a war to fight now. She treats them like a bunch of annoying kids getting under her feet. And she doesn't know what they're doing, that they're basically involved in some other plot. Although then she starts to realise and then says, yeah, well, fair enough, you're not really playing at it, and I understand your concerns. But they have to relearn to run their own society. They have to go back to doing all these jobs that are regarded as a bit icky, like, you know, that were done by other races, like farming, and, you know, nobody wants to be a cook, but how are you going to eat? And so there's all these issues that they have to learn respect for new trades, and it's the women who are driving that.
And I also found it interesting, I mean, they were a technologically advanced species before they, you know, were co-opted by the Covenant, but they've kind of, that knowledge almost became vestigial, and they just lost it because they relied on all the other parts of the Covenant.
Well, for me, the really big key thing when I looked at all the species was engineers. They seem to be key to me. There's so much reliance put on them, I thought, we've got to have some of those in. And you know, by the end of the book, I thought, right, if I could choose for real a couple of things, real stuff to have from Halo to make my life easier, I want an AI like BB, and I want an engineer. You could just leave them to do all this stuff.
An engineer that specializes in making delicious coffee.
Oh yeah, coffee. But I mean, you could just leave them to do the house. But they just fascinated me. I mean, what motivates them? Where did they all go? What happens when you pull them out? When the whole war machine's run on them, and suddenly they're not there. Things break down. They suddenly have enormous value.
One of my favorite Halo books is Contact Harvest, and I really appreciated the characterization of the engineers in that. And you actually, for the first time, really realize they're thinking machine. They're kind of organic machines, but they think and they have emotions. They have feelings. They aren't just mindlessly doing these things. They're doing these things because it's their nature. It's in their way, but they can go against their nature if they find it important and it's emotionally relevant for them. I actually think. Yeah, the engineers are kind of an untapped character in some way.
Yeah, and you can also get quite fond of them, and you know, when you actually see how weak they are, and that they are quite vulnerable. They're not terribly good at organising themselves. They will, you know, as we've seen in previous books, they will lash out. But I just thought, what happens if you introduce an ODST to one of these? And they actually do go after one because the opportunity presents itself, and this is an amazing piece of technology that they can use to basically data strip. And ONI wants one. They've occasionally got them in the past, but they want one. So they go and hijack this vessel to basically liberate this thing and take it away.
And importantly, liberate it quietly so that nobody knows that they have it.
But then they've got this creature that they give a name to, and they start to worry, what happens when we hand it back to Margaret Parangoski? What is she going to do to it? And that starts to freak them out a bit because they suddenly see this sort of helpless, timid, rather lovely creature that's constantly fiddling with things and rebuilding their armor like a charming child, and they're sort of almost feeding it like a pet. And they're starting to say, well, should we really be handing that over to those people? What are they going to do to it? You know, because their imaginations are running overtime now. And for the very first time, and although the readers and players have known this for a long time, most of Earth society does not know how the Spartans came about. They do not know how they were made. They do not know what happened to them.
They don't know how old they were when they started the program.
That's it. They don't know that these were basically abused children. And I just thought, this is one of those things where you're used to revealing things to readers and players, but the interesting thing is to reveal to the characters what the reader and the player already knows and see their reactions, which is, if you were told this is what you're the good guys, and you're told this is what your government did to 6-year-old kids and their families, and watch the reaction. It's really shocking. I mean, the more you think about it, it's absolutely horrific because you know that the enemy didn't do that. It makes you wonder. Yeah, I mean, I like these moral grey areas, actually quite dark grey areas when you come to some of them. But so that's an interesting thing from a writer's point of view, technically, to reveal what is already known, but reveal it in a different way, so you get this whole new perspective and characters look at it a different way.
It's like you said, there are no war crimes for the victors, right? These are all necessary sacrifices. You know, they were risky experiments and so on. So a lot of the guilt and a lot of this kind of trial that does go on in the book is really just happening inside Halsey's mind, for example. She has a lot of time to reflect and think about things, and I don't think that you soften her in any way. In fact, I think that exposing even the little moments of that she has actually makes her a much more brittle person and a much more frightening person. Because the fact is, she can reflect on this stuff, but apparently chose to go ahead with it anyway.
Yes. And as we see from the things she does while she's stranded in the Dyson sphere, is that she would do it again. She'd always find a way of justifying it. And I think what some readers might find challenging is we actually see Mendes in depth. And this is not a soft or deferential man. This is a hard guy. This is a guy who's trained Spartans. This is a guy with his own service record who's gone along with Halsey. I mean, he sort of found out a little too late, but he never walked away from it. And he's now carrying a massive burden of guilt, and he does not like her. Part of that is not liking himself, I think, for saying, why did I go along with this woman? But there's a really very aggressive relationship between them because they are now stuck. They are stuck in this enclosed space, facing each other with the fruits of their rather grubby labors.
Yeah.
And you've got the Spartan Threes who, there's almost a sort of moral argument going on about my Spartan Threes are less abused than your Spartan Twos.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at how they were actually used militarily, the Spartan Threes, yeah. Once they were trained, were abused far more. Yeah. They were expected. They were expendable from the beginning.
They were just cannon fodder. And it's really interesting when the ODSTs, I mean, Vaz is the other ODST, and he's the younger Russian guy. And when he realizes how old the Spartan Threes are now and what they've been through and how traumatized they are, it's like, what side am I on? And I mean, we also obviously look at, you know, some of the really damaged ones. I mean, Lucy's the most damaged of all, and I found her interesting. Now, that's, again, I hope this isn't giving too much away, but Lucy is a POV character, and doing a point-of-view character who doesn't speak is very challenging. And, perhaps it's going too far to say what happens to her, but...
Yeah. But you definitely capture her sense of frustration, and you do it in an interesting way. I mean, I'm going to give away a spoiler, because it happens very early in the book, is that Lucy is one of a couple of people trying to teach an engineer how to communicate. And there's some irony in that for her, and the sense of frustration as she's trying to teach this engineer how to properly communicate, ostensibly in order to save its life in a way, is really fascinating. But there's another thing that happens in that segment of the story that I love, because you asked me about this early on when you were working on it, was what do you eat on a Forerunner? Abandoned Forerunner world. Is there food? Is it poisonous? Is it dangerous? And when I was a kid, especially, and it's a thing that some literature does, but a surprising amount of literature doesn't. When you're a kid, reading about food is really fascinating. You think about Willy Wonka, or you maybe grew up with a Famous Five like I did, this Enid Blyton set of characters. And every single book had all these amazing scenes where they were starving, and eventually they got canned peaches and lashings of ginger beer. But when you were a kid, it was like quite exciting. It was like a little party was going on. These people were having food that you're not really supposed to eat. But the Spartans have the opposite problem. There are no lashings of ginger beer, and there's no food, and they don't know what is safe to eat, and they don't really have any good way to analyze stuff, so they're kind of experimenting. And there's a real Robinson Crusoe thing going on that early on in the book that's strangely fascinating to me, probably because I was hungry.
So kind of taking it back to a little more broader themes a little bit, this is the first significant outside of the return by Mr. Kevin Grace post-Halo 3 fiction.
Kevin is actually interestingly lounging on a bed right now watching us.
Yeah, he's...
Languorous, like a panther.
I languor. Thank you.
But I'm wondering, this is a question actually for both Frank and Karen. Knowing that there are threads in these stories that are going to be tying into to future games, future products going forward, how do you start? How do you decide what threads go where and how they should work? I mean, does this process come from Frank and Kevin mostly, or is there a lot of collaboration going back and forth on what you think works?
I mean, initially, our early conversations were actually in this very hotel downstairs at breakfast, and we're talking about the very simple seeds. Karen's story, I mean, I've mentioned this before, is going to tie quite directly into events that happen in Halo 4. At least threads are going to connect directly to Halo 4. Not necessarily characters, but threads. And we knew where Halo 4 started and where Halo 4 ends. And so we had some basic goalposts, but we really said we're interested in exploring this period of like 3 or 4 years. And Karen's first book doesn't go all the way into that. That period is the very early days. And we said, we want to explore this. This is the setup. It's the post-Covenant War. There's chaos. There are factions fighting for power and control. And Karen just kind of ran with that. And that's the honest truth, is Karen had some ideas about things that she wanted to explore. And so early on, she brought those up to us. She said, what about Halsey? What about the Forerunner world? What about this stuff? Can I go explore ODSTs? Can I go explore the Office of Naval Intelligence and blah, blah, blah? So most of it was like, sort of tent poles, agreement on those, and then run with it. And as long as she doesn't go past a certain day, literally the sky's the limit. We said, we would like to introduce this thing, the big thing that we introduced, and we'd like to introduce maybe this character and so on, just so that people start to learn a little bit about it. But other than that, it's really all Karen's. And that's the truth. She understands the rules of the Halo universe innately anyway, and it's her book. Those are her characters and her ideas. It's not like we're, as you said yesterday, we didn't hire a secretary, we hired a novelist, right? So
I do take good shorthand there. I still do, yeah. No, I mean, basically, I'm a very mechanistic person, and I think sometimes when I do panels and I tell people what my writing process is, they just think, that's just so robotic. But it's a process. I'm all about process management. You know, you've got to work with people who've got their own demands. You know, they've got to make their game work. So I basically say if I'm doing a novel within a game, what do you need me to do? Where do you need me to reach at the end of this process? Is what are your non-negotiables? What have you got to have in there? Who have you got to have in there? How far can I go with this? How far can I go with that? And I just kept bouncing it back and forth. I mean, we've exchanged an enormous amount of email. I mean, we have hogged bandwidth on an absolutely epic scale. We really have huge numbers of emails. And the thing for me, though, is very tiny detail changes things. One line is a whole pivot. It changes the motivation of a character. So ask incredibly tiny, nitpicky questions. But, you know, Kevin and Frank answered endlessly patiently about... One of the things that does interest me is, if you're writing soldiers, one of the things, if you're in the field, is how your uniform fits, all the discomforts and all that. And it's like, I do this with every IP. It's like, you know, basically, what's it like to wear the armor? Where does this go? How much movement have they got? Because that's what puts the reader behind the character's eyes. Mm-hmm. They know what it feels like. And, you know, anyone in uniform will tell you, you know, it's about how long you can... you know, how comfortable things are, whether your kit works, because kit notoriously fails. And, you know, you sort of see the Spartans with all this super-duper kit, and the ODSTs are a bit, well, you know, we got the light version. You know, and there's a bit of sort of fingers drumming on tables. But
and that's everywhere in the services. Yeah. Everyone's jealous of what everyone else has.
Well, you know, I mean, you want something that works because your life depends on it, and you want something that doesn't chafe. When you're wearing it, it really does come down to that. But I don't know if you've got to the bit about where they actually see us. They actually see Naomi, the Spartan, their pet Spartan, suit up for the first time, and it really gets quite, you know. Because I thought, where does everything fit? I mean, I'm not going to spoil it for readers, but I just thought, there's, you know, what soldiers would do, you know, what Marines would do if they had to watch that process. And they, you know, the questions that I'd ask.
Well, yeah, for years, I mean, the inevitable question is, do Spartans wear diapers and where do they go?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I actually said to Frank and Kevin, you know, can I go into that? And as you know, a sort of friend of mine way back used to say, it wouldn't be a Travis book if there weren't bodily functions and vomiting in it. And it's absolutely true, because, you know, that's what grounds a lot of this stuff. It's about... what would your day be like if you really were a Spartan or an ODST? What would it feel like? Yeah. How long have you got to be in that armor?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, when we were playing the game itself, you know, I'm going to save the galaxy, I'm going to bring down a Covenant spacecraft, blah, blah, blah. You're going to do all these things. Honestly, like, if I had to run the length of one of the smaller levels, like Lockout, or just run a lap of the pit in real life, I would die, right? I would drop down dead. And I think video games make you forget about the very human discomforts and the very human reality of even just being in an environment. Or Lord knows, like, if I snipe and cam for hours, I can't even squat on my haunches for that long without getting pins and needles or cramp. And it's, you know, following a soldier through a battlefield. And
Cameron, we talked about the, obviously, being here for San Diego Comic-Con. You're heading back to England on Monday. But next time we'll be seeing you here in the States is going to be up at Halo Fest at the end of August.
Absolutely.
Have you done, obviously done San Diego Comic Cons or anything like that. Have you done, like, specific cons for any of the IPs you've worked on in the past?
Yes. But, I mean, this is particularly special. I mean, apart from the fact that it's Halo's 10th, it's also part of PAX. And, you know, the Penny Arcade guys are terrific, and they're good friends, and I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to absorbing the atmosphere there.
I'm waiting for you to record a walk-on roll onto the Red vs. Blue series.
Oh, it's gotta happen. Red vs. Blue. Oh, yeah, yeah. I am not worthy. Seriously, that was the best thing ever. When I was offered the Halo gig, I have a friend who's a Halo nut, and she sent me an email, and she said, okay, if you want to get Halo'd up, she said, I know that you've got to separate, that you can't be a sort of fan of things you write. I know your ground rules on that you've got to discover, but there's no harm in you getting into Red vs. Blue. But, she said, I will accept no responsibility for how much time you waste. Do not come back griping to me. So I thought, oh, what? Yeah, how good can this be? And I got to the page, and I went. I started the first episode. Nine seasons later, I lost about two or three days, and I was. I mean, you might have seen people who were around yesterday. You actually see me fangirl over the Red versus Blue team, because what they can do with just guys in helmets with no facial expression. I was so taken in by it in the first few episodes that I was brokenhearted when people died. And it's like, for a writer, you know where those strings are. You know how those tricks happen. And to be able to dissociate that much, to actually experience it as an ordinary person rather than someone who knows how the thing is put together, I was just utterly in love with it, and I still am. It still makes my Tuesday morning, which is obviously because of the time difference, right. That's when I bug into it. I just think, I just love it. I just absolutely adore it, and I'm hope. Yeah, I will put in a few little Easter eggs in the book just to pay homage to that. I really will.
I mean, weirdly, my most recent Red versus Blue memory is the scene from an early episode in season 9 where they're watching the heat trail of this thermal imaging device, and they see these two beeps moving through on the heat map, and there's a build up all this tension, and build up this tension about, and then two cups of coffee come around the door.
In terms of comic timing, yeah. I mean, they're a testimony to how really good dialogue and really good timing. It's almost a sort of radio drama skill.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. And, I mean, you just really believe in the characters. I was sort of saying to them yesterday, bring back Lopez, please bring back Lopez.
Yeah, it's actually one of the things I'm looking forward to. Obviously, for Halo Fest, it's, I think every day, Allison and I, when we're in the office, it's like counting down. It's like, oh my God, it's this close. Oh my God, it's only
34 days, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, that keeps us up some nights. Well, 34 days when we recorded this, but yeah, it's coming around the bend, and I'm really looking forward to it. I never experienced it from this side. Of being kind of behind the scenes and putting these things on. I've gone to a lot of these conventions in the past, so I'm looking forward to it. And we're doing a Machinima contest. If you go to HaloWaypoint.com, you can see all the details for that. So other people can do it, then they'll have the ability. I think there's going to be some tournaments. I think one of the prizes is someone's going to be able to win a walk-on role on Red vs. Blue.
Oh, right.
You'll be able to do a voiceover. So those guys, the Rooster Teeth guys, we have a great relationship with them. And it's been fun to see how accommodating they are to the fans and actually making them a part of that. I don't know. I enjoy that quite a bit myself.
I think that's that's one of the things that makes Halo special for me, is that you've got this ability to sort of take in some of your fandom and make them part of the mainstream of it. And you can also laugh at yourselves, and that is a wonderful thing. That's a really healthy creative position to be in.
Yeah, Frankie had a question about yesterday about the codpiece gate from E3, the tale of the missing or not so missing codpiece, as it were. But
these are the trials that are set as we in the trailer for Halo 4. The chief appears to not be wearing a club piece. He is in fact wearing a black armored piece of crotchal material. that's canonistic. We were expecting, we have all these lists of things that people are going to freak out about. We know what they are, like the redesigned armor, what's that new weapon?
It never came up.
What was the, what stuff is in the forward onto Dawn, blah, 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 what's that world, is that foreigner? We get the stuff down to fine art, and then first thing in the forum is like, where's his cod piece?
There's some deep Freudian anxieties going
about
that.
Eyes up here, ladies. it was pretty weird.
You just never predict what's going to happen over these things. So, well, Karen, I know you're very busy here at San Diego this weekend, so I think we're going to wrap things up here in a little bit. But I think we're going to be trying to do another segment. So, but in case that doesn't work out, I'll have something else for you. So, Karen, thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate it. And we'll be seeing you at Halo Fest.
Indeed.
Welcome, everyone. We're back with the 343 Sparkcast, recording in some new digs, which we'll maybe talk about a little bit later. But first things first, I want to introduce everyone that's with us today. I'm David Ellis, content producer at 343,
And I'm joined once again, Frank O'Connor, Franchise Development Director.
Howdy.
And joining us for the first time on the mic, although he's no stranger to the microphone and camera post E3, is Dan Ayoub, Executive Producer here at 343.
How's it going?
And last but certainly not least, who gets the award, I think you get the award for traveling the furthest to be on the Sparkcast, is Max Hoberman, owner of Certain Affinity. Welcome, Max.
Hey, how's it going?
You're no stranger to this neck of the woods up here in the Northwest.
Or even this room.
Exactly.
I spent many a late night in this room. Me and Marty alone.
Oh, boy. We're going to edit.
It's a beautiful thing.
We're already at the point that's what, edit, Max.
That's what that smell is.
Unfortunately, I didn't bring any rose petals or champagne. So, like I said, this is our first podcast post E3, which are two big announcements, of course, was Halo Anniversary and Halo 4. And what we're going to talk about today is a little bit of the experiences of everyone that was there at E3 demoing stuff. That's always a lot of fun. It's always kind of frightening ahead of time. You're not quite sure how people are going to react to things, and always get fantastic questions that you hear over and over and over and over again. So by the end of the week, you're a pro at answering them. So how was your E3?
Well, you said Dan was a pro?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Just make sure I heard correctly.
Wow, really? We're going there already?
Yeah, going there.
I didn't say what he was a professional at.
It's already gone pear-shaped. Yeah. 45 seconds into the...
All right, I'm sorry. I'll keep it clean.
E3 was good, right? I mean, I think we got a lot of good questions. We got some good reactions to the stuff we were showing.
Yeah.
To your point, we got really, really good at doing the demo. Although, you know, I will share with you my favorite demo moment of all of E3. Was I think it was the final day, and you're doing this by three, four days by this point, and everyone's exhausted. And it got to the point where I wasn't even looking at the screen anymore for when I was talking to Marsh Field. Frank knows where I'm going with this. And at some point, like I'm just talking, I hear Frank laughing in the corner, and I hear one of the journalists say, "Wow, he's really bad, isn't he?" And Dennis, our producer, who was demoing, to his credit, you know, he'd been doing it God knows how many times by this point, had managed to sticky grenade.
Wait a minute. So you're saying that this person who should now be a super expert at throwing grenades deserves credit. But stuck his face twice.
He stuck his face. So I hear Frank laughing, and I turn, and it was literally like a cartoon, because luckily Dennis had God mode on. He'd chosen this moment to do it. And it was literally like a cartoon, because I just see this glow running in a circle while everyone in the room is laughing.
Screaming, help!
Screaming,
help!
Trying to get the sticky grenade off his face. That by far is my most memory.
That was awesome.
And since he's not here, I can say this. If I had to watch Dennis play all day, every day, I'd probably not be looking at the screen either.
Come on.
What?
There was a lot of skill involved in bouncing that grenade off the only spot on that whole rock that would make it go back in your face. Anything else, it would have just slid off or slid straight by. But it was amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
It was fun, actually. I sat in on a couple of the demos on the last day. And in every single time, I know you guys had seen it, 40 or 50 times at that point, but every time you'd do this, they'd switch between the new graphics to the classic graphics back and forth every single time. Like, it got such a reaction from people because it's just, I don't know, people, they've done it, other games have done it in like 2D, but I don't know of any 3D games that have really done this before, especially being able to do it in real time while you're playing live. It's still the coolest feature for me.
I literally had the same reaction every single time it went. I mean, I didn't gasp like a couple of people did the first time, but every time we did the switch, I felt the same thing the room felt. And part of that's just, the crowd sort of amping each other up. But like every time we did the switch, I had a genuine reaction to it every time we did that switch. So
yeah, we were really happy about that. I mean, as I said there, and I agree, I think people had the biggest reaction to that. And on a personal level, it's the feature I'm most excited about. And I think it's really magical if you're a Halo fan to just be able to see that and go back and forth. But it's almost like looking at 10 years of gaming evolution at the touch of a button as well, right? Like even going beyond it. But yeah, no, it was cool. And, the story I liked telling at E3 is the irony is that started as a menu item. And when we initially started thinking about this, it was just like, oh, well, we'll let you choose to play in classic or we'll let you choose to play in new. And just at some point, everyone just got so jazzed about it here at 343. We just got to the point where we're like, yeah, no, you need to do this at any point during the game. And I think that's probably what got the biggest oohs and ahs coming out of E3.
And it's funny, we were demoing Silent Cartographer. Majority of what we were demoing was Silent Cartographer. And you see it, and I think there were a lot of press people like, oh, this looks better, but kind of looks like it did in my mind. And then the first time you switch and you see what it actually did look like, I mean, it's very clean and it actually has held up pretty well. But when you compare it to what it looks like, the work that Saber has done and the new graphics layer, it's really quite jarring when you see it the first time.
Yeah, you know, I always say memory is a funny thing, right? I think a lot of people have a very emotional reaction to the game the first time they did it. And it's like watching your favorite movie when you were a kid again. And, you know, in your mind, it was fantastic. And then you see, you know, the example I always use is like Crawler Clash of the Titans when I was growing up, right? It was like, that movie's still state of the art today. And then you watch it at like 3 o'clock in the morning and you weep silently and vow never to watch it again. Yeah.
But how is that different than every other night for you?
Yeah, you know, my nights usually end with me weeping silently, but honestly. So, you know, it's usually par for the course.
Well, you know, I sat in on that one demo that you did, and I don't know who the guy in the room was. There's some guy who, when I introduced myself, he said he was like a professional player and gave me his card. But when you were doing the demo, when you got to the multiplayer stuff and you kind of did that same switch of the old and the new, and that's when he started cheering, which I thought was pretty funny.
I just assumed you'd paid him off quite a lot.
Seriously.
No, that
group, was, they were all quiet until then, and then they like erupted. It was cool.
The funny thing about that demo and that part of the video, in fact, is that I think that, given that people had already been through that, I've had that reaction process, that when you switch in Damnation and you see the water effects, especially, that was, I think that kind of doubled down, because that was, to your point earlier, David, like when you switch back to some places on Truth and Reconciliation or on Halo, it still looks good, right? And that's testament to art rather than technology, right? It's like, oh, that was really well designed and that was really well sort of thought out and created. And then you do the switch and it's the technology that you're really gasping at. But in Damnation, it's the change in art as well. So you kind of compound it, and there's lots of opportunities there. But the best demonstration I've seen in campaign of that switch now is in Pillar of Autumn, which we were just looking at the other day.
Right.
And it's this switch is huge, because Pillar of Autumn is, and it's surprising because you expect it to be an incredibly simplistic level. I mean, it's tunnels and corridors and but when you do the switch, you have all these lighting effects and kind of dust particulates in the light. And it's just incredibly jarring switch in Pillar of Autumn, but it still looks like the Pillar of Autumn.
There are shadows.
Shadows, yeah. Gloomy, dangerous, yeah.
Is a particulate the same thing as a particle, Frank?
Well, yeah, sure. Why not? It is.
You know, one of the other things, in speaking to Damnation and the multiplayer, we had a lot of feedback from people online. Anniversary is actually, we knew this before we announced it. It's a complicated project and game to talk about, because it has various components. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the old engine, you have the new engine, and then you have the difference between single player, which includes online co-op for the first time in the campaign, but you also have the multiplayer, which is built off of the Reach tool set. And we want to talk a little bit more about kind of this further decision-making process on why we end up going the way we did, and why ultimately we think it's the best decision for everyone to kind of experience these maps again.
I mean, well, you know, before we announced that, we all had conversations. What is the reaction going to be like about this thing? And we nailed that. I mean, we didn't see a single surprising reaction. We knew that people would be super mad that we didn't translate Halo's multiplayer component and just add a networking layer on top of it. And we weren't surprised by that. And we didn't make that decision because we thought that necessarily one path was absolutely better than the other. Or we had to juggle so many different pieces of that puzzle. There were resources, scheduling, technology, legacy issues. There are hundreds of problems. And every time I give an example, some kid who's rightfully opinionated about it, like he would prefer if Halo CE's MP was translated, picks the example that I give of one of 100 reasons why and says, oh, so you didn't do it because the pistol is overbalanced. Well, it's not, and here's why. And so it doesn't matter which example of the myriad reasons that we made that decision that you use, people are going to be mad about it. Because I mean, I'd like to see the MP translated, but there wasn't time, there wasn't resources, there were lots of other considerations, including the Reach population, a million reasons.
Well, you know, some of that, we were talking about the visuals earlier, and, you know, people's memory of the visuals is sometimes a little different than, you know, the reality. Yeah. And I would say a lot of that goes, and I'm sure this is heresy for some people, but as a designer, I can say a lot of that goes for the game mechanics also. Not all of that your memory is better than the actual reality sometimes.
A lot of your enjoyment was culled from, I'll stand by this and I'll argue this, was culled from the social experience of being in a system link. I heard a lot of people saying, why didn't you just put an Xbox Kinect layer or Xbox Kai on top of it? You know, a tunneling layer?
Those are good days.
Yeah, let's all be clear in this room, that works and people enjoy playing it that way. But that would be completely unacceptable. Not that we'd ever have considered just layering tunneling on top of it anyway, but the people's memories of how that experience functioned are definitely faulty because we've done it in the best circumstances possible and it breaks down after like four or five players and it's not an ideal experience. But again, that's not the only reason why we didn't do it. There are dozens.
Yeah, I mean, and you guys have talked a little bit about, and we'll be talking about more in the coming weeks and months, offering options for players to actually have a more classic like experience in these maps.
Yeah, I mean, you know, going back to what Frank and Max were saying, yeah, there were a ton. I mean, the Reach population was really a big. I mean, for me, that was a huge one because obviously we want these new maps to be available as DLC. And if you're the Reach guy, that for I don't know why you wouldn't want to just go out and get all of Anniversary, because you totally should, because it's awesome.
or two.
On November 15th, $40 value.
Yeah, available now. Check your local business. but we did want to give you the ability to go back and forth and let those populations play together.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was really, really important to us, that the most number of people, as many people as possible, could enjoy it.
I mean, when we're being... Most of the reaction, honestly, has been really positive and really, really cool. And even the people having the negative conversations are having really interesting conversations. But this isn't a big money play for Microsoft. We're not expecting to sell tens of millions of units, and we're not expecting to make hundreds of millions of dollars.
Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Oh, Max. Yeah, we've got some really bad news.
I was giving Frank the evil eye. Like, Max is in the room.
That's not what you told me.
But you said that you love the kids. So
I think I saw a quote somewhere where I think it was from you, Dan, where you said, "We love this so much, we would do it for free."
Yeah, well, Dan would say a lot of executives wouldn't.
To be clear, that was not me.
I think it was actually Dennis on the last podcast. Yeah.
I mean, it's totally true, Frank. It's definitely true.
But we would. I mean, everyone in this room is doing it for love. I mean, we need a salary. We need to pay our, you know, mortgages and all that. But I mean, we would, if we could get away with it, we would do it for free. Of course we would. But it's... You can do it for free because you have to pay all the other people to do the work.
I'll accept that with qualifiers.
Yeah.
and it's a fair point. And I think you've said this before, Frank. This isn't a project that was mandated from on high.
No, this was homegrown. This was completely organic. We said we're celebrating 10 years of Halo in 2011. What would be really epic way to celebrate it?
And we had to actually sell it to people internally at Microsoft. Oh, yeah. This was a worthwhile project.
Right up until 6 months ago.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's been a long process of pushing, right? And I mean, this is something 343 felt really strongly about. I know Frank felt really strongly about it. So did I. So did I mean, you know, everyone involved in the project felt really strongly about it. And it's, how do we respond?
Except
to
Chad. He was like, "Yeah, whatever."
Yeah, but that's just Chad. I can't control him. He goes Broken Arrow on me daily. No, but you know, but the notion is, the 10th anniversary is coming up. This is something the community's been asking for a really long time, right? And like, how can we not do it? And you know, it's almost like the duh factor. Like, this is just something we need to do at this point.
Well, so going back for a minute, I'm probably jumping ahead in your agenda here, but I just have to add this because I think it's really important. Like, I played the hell out of these multiplayer maps in the early days.
You have a little bit of experience.
Yeah, a little tiny bit. And in all honesty, the reason to go with the Reach engine and Reach multiplayer and integrating into that whole ecosystem, a huge part of it for me is trying out all of the changes that have, you know, come along since then, the mechanics changes and new weapons, new vehicles, and armor mods especially. Getting that stuff actually applied to the old maps for me, that's actually what makes this stuff, you know, not be like, that's kind of fun, but I've played it before, but actually be like a whole new experience. And I'm not just saying that.
No,
like,
I know.
Really,
I mean,
big deal.
Early on, one of the most exciting things that Max said to me was that I want to make sure that every single one of these maps is all about armor lock. and he went, and that's how he went about designing them. So, no, but Max is absolutely right. The Reach pilot, the Reach sandbox.
I mean, yeah, I did. That was my plan, very much. But keep going. Sorry,
but the Reach sandbox really does add a lot to it. As David mentioned, and as Dan tried to jump on him to prevent him from mentioning, is that we're going to do things that are going to make the classic experience super classic. Like, our fingers are crossed that we'll be able to do really cool things in matchmaking to make a very sort of original, compelling Halo classic experience. But the Reach stuff is really cool. I mean, honestly, sprinting on Hang 'em High, can I say that? Is awesome.
May or may not exist. You may or may not have
may
seen
or may
it
not
in
get
the tree.
Yeah.
One map in particular that isn't fully textured and lit yet, that doesn't come from Halo 1, is my favorite in terms of how it works with the Reach sandbox. I mean, just sprinting on it changes the whole thing, but in such a cool way. And everything just feels really good based on the map choices. It worked out really well, I think.
And that's, you know, one huge benefit of doing this stuff in the Reach engine is also just having the Forge support in there.
Yeah.
It actually allows us to do, you know, we were talking earlier and you were asking about the maps, and it actually allows us to do maps that are really much closer to the original than if we were, you know, if we didn't have it, because, you know, you can add a new corridor if you want. And then if you want to play in classic mode, you block it off and it's as if it wasn't there. And that's just been awesome. It's given us this huge flexibility to do interesting creative things, yet still have it be true to the original map.
And Beaver Creek is a perfect example of that. I mean, we've talked about before on the last podcast that there will be kind of two versions of each one of the maps. There's a new version, and then there's what, you know, right now is labeled classic, which kind of replicates it as close as possible to the original settings. Like Beaver Creek, I mean, you in the new version, at least in its current iteration, it may change between now and ship, who knows, but you have you know, lifts in the back rather than teleporters, and you actually have a separate teleporter room that's actually built into the rock wall.
Yep.
Well, which, shit, now you gave it all away.
Well, no, we can talk a little, you know,
his description was so horrific, no one will be able to imagine what.
Where the hell is it? I got the jetpack.
I think it's upside down.
No, it's one of those spots where, because in Halo 2 especially, I camped the hell out of the back of Beaver.
It actually reminds me a little bit like a mini base in Sidewinder. It's like the back bases in Sidewinder.
Yeah, when we started to add these new things, I think everyone had a similar reaction to. I know I did. It's like, no, we said we were going to be true. Like, what? Like, what's going on, right? And then you play it, and, you know, obviously, as we were saying, you still have the option to go back and play it in a more classic way if you want. But when you get in there and play it and see, like, oh, this is actually kind of neat. It's kind of a new take on an old classic. And I think Max and his team have, A, done a really good job making it, you know, not feel like in your face. And, B, ironically, every time I go down there to play something new that I'm worried about, I'm pretty sure they're letting me win. I'm like, yeah, this is awesome, guys. Let's just do this.
That's called a press mode.
Yeah.
No comment.
I knew it.
But it's you know, Hang 'em High is a funny one because it's actually a fairly big area. But it, with the Reach palette, it addresses a complaint a lot of people have had that there aren't enough small maps. Because Hang 'em High, you can traverse it really quick.
Yeah.
And it may not be a physically small map, but it's a very understandable space and a very easy place to have. Even you can even do a one-on-one fight in it. That's not optimal, but you can totally do it and easily track down your opponent.
Well, I know we haven't announced all the maps yet, but there's actually a number of maps that scratch that particular itch.
Yes,
that
small map itch.
I'm very, very excited about
that. Beaver Creek
definitely
does it, and Damnation, it's actually a little bit more mid-sized.
And the one we were looking at in that meeting the other day definitely does that.
Yes, indeed.
And I just saw that, the latest pass on that recently.
Yeah.
It looks...
Yeah, I don't think you should get rid of the lights.
All of them.
No, seriously. You said
that, this is why we put you in the back corner, because you can't get off the
light. But I think the lights look good.
No, it looks
the bright
awesome.
Lights. You know the ones
level
I mean.
That shall not be named is is looking pretty damn slick.
But we are putting Dan on the spot here.
I know. It's and he gets final say, so he'll probably make me bleep it. Don't make me bleep it. it's funny. We're recording this not long after E3, and we won't be putting it out until July, probably right before San Diego Comic-Con. So we should probably talk a little bit about what people are going to be seeing at Comic-Con, maybe teasing it. I mean, we're talking about that at all, what people will be seeing there. Maybe publicly for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, publicly what people are going to get a chance to see, we're going to be showing examples of a little bit of everything, quite honestly. So single player, we're going to be showing Silent Cartographer, so people get a chance to check that out. One of the things also, I think, especially considering the crowd at Comic-Con, that people are going to get really excited about is our new take on terminals, which are, you know, we're moving away from text on a screen to something a lot more visual, motion comic-y.
Yeah.
We don't even like the term
motion comic
it doesn't really do it justice. Yeah. But it's a pretty slick implementation, a really cool way to tell terminals. And I think that was another surprise hit for me at E3 was how strongly people reacted to that. Like when we got the, you know, because we kind of said, oh, we're doing this new take on terminals, and everyone kind of cocked their heads and looked at us. And then when we showed it to them, people are just really excited.
Yeah, so. And some very enterprising press folks were recording audio recording of the demos.
We only gave one person permission to do that, and it's because she was hot. right?
Let's be clear. Frank gave one person
money. Oh, she was so and it's because tall she was hot. Oh, my God.
But that particular trailer, which we showed, was an example of – we actually have recorded with the original voice actor for Guilty Spark,
yep.
Tenda Dabo. Mm-hmm. And you know, people have just been even dissecting what mm-hmm. he's saying on that. And it's funny because –
that's awesome.
We've seen it, hearing it really –
well, people were complaining about the premise of the story based on his VO for just the trailer. It is a trailer.
Awesome. Yeah, there's like specifically
well, he
for the
can't,
trailer.
How could he know that if they didn't know that? I'm like, he's just doing a trailer VO. It's like they in a world, but voiced by Tim Dabo. So yeah, we're really actually excited about the story. It's actually super pertinent to the events of Halo, and there are a couple of little connections to future game events.
And people have asked a little bit, and we've talked in very vague terms so far, and we'll be getting in a little bit more as we get closer to launch. People are like, well, Guilty Spark can't be narrating a terminal on the Pillar of Autumn. That doesn't make any sense.
Or does it?
Bum, bum, bum.
Leave you wanting more.
Yeah.
People would be able to see a live demo of Silent Cartographer. They'll be able to actually see the graphic switching in real time. Mm-hmm. We'll be releasing not only just there, but I would think the plan is that we're going to be releasing a video showcasing a live demo as well.
But when are you guys going to have multiplayer hands-on? That's what I want to know.
This afternoon, if you want, we can just go play.
Oh, Max, I'm sorry.
Let's just play the secret.
You can play anytime you want.
Exactly.
We're not even letting Max play. Oh. Like, that's how top secret multiplayer is for us right now. No, I mean, but that does bring up a good point, right? I mean, obviously, as we get closer to launch, and in particular, as we get closer to Halo Fest,
mm-hmm.
we're going to be doing more and more with the multiplayer components. And, you know, the video that we're giving people access to right now is to whet the appetite. And get people, but you know, what I can say is that, yeah, people will get a chance to get hands on the multiplayer before we launch, obviously.
But, we don't have anything locked down, but I think, you know, probably will be likely as we get closer to Halo Fest, maybe putting out some gameplay footage out there so people can kind of get a taste mm-hmm. of that as well. Good opportunity. Cause
as long
we
as
did
the footage of Frank playing. It's all good.
Well, I mean, if Aisha Tyler shows up and asks to play, then we'll just be like, yeah. Right.
Wait, and
just break down all our marketing strategy.
What's the footage going to be of?
You mentioned
Frank Cam.
Yeah, I noticed Frank completely dodged that question.
I didn't dodge it. I was thinking about it. I was playing it back in my mind, all slow.
But after San Diego Comic Con, the next big place for us, obviously, is Halo Fest. It's kind of our home base here.
That's August. That, somebody said 8 weeks, and I was like, no, we've got
Yeah,
I think we all kind of had a panic attack because August seems so far.
No, it's really coming together. I was looking at photographs of some of the objects that they're assembling. They're sitting in a warehouse. There is some cool pieces of Halo memorabilia and history, and it's all coming together. And we're looking at
life size fusion cores.
Trash cans disguised as life. And they are explosive, so don't put your trash in.
It's all good.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I just saw some of those renders for some of the spaces for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's the first time it's been talked about. We've seen sketches, but it looks and feels.
The scary part is the missing component is the human component. And really what the celebration is about people. And so you look at all these things and you're like, is this going to be enough for people to do? And then you're saying, well, we might get a log jam here as people do this, and we can't have people playing that there. And you start to realize this is really about humans moving through this.
And that's, I mean,
I remember that there was that whole launch party where they had the ladies dressed up as Cortana. That was awesome. But your idea of the whole people dressed up as the flood spore forms, I don't know, Frank.
Well, no, those were just people who hadn't washed. That's a very common thing at Comic-Con, not so much a PAX, cleaner crowd. I would say, you know, we'll use this as a clarion call. If you want to dress up in costumes, we're going to be rewarding people who dress up in costumes.
Oh,
so
it
doesn't just have to be Cortana. You can go with something way less sexy than
for some, and for some people, it shouldn't be Cortana.
Yeah, please.
Why are you keeping me down?
Why are you oppressing?
You can come as Cortana.
Why are you oppressing Husky Jedi?
But, I mean, my concern with Halo Fest is just that there's going to be tons of people where it's all sold out for PAX mm-hmm. and Halo Fest. It's just,
it's exciting. It's
really?
Right?
Have you guys announced how many people are going
to
be there?
Well, between, I mean, PAX and it, we're adjacent to PAX right across the street, but part of it, I mean, all of PAX is sold out. I mean, PAX East, I think this past year, had 75,000 people there. So mm-hmm. it's going to be order of magnitude larger. But we're going to have a lot of stuff for people to do, and we'll be talking about more of that stuff. I mean, you can expect, if you've been to a convention before, you can expect a lot of the same stuff. Like get a chance to meet some people that,
Get a chance to meet Max.
Yes.
Am I going to be?
I think
you're a VIP.
Max about the kissing booth?
He's a VIP guest for the party.
That was a dunking booth.
We forgot to invite Max. Oh, awkward.
Wow, this is the most awkward podcast ever. Yeah.
No, I've seen Max's name on the invite list for the VIP party.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Secret VIP party. We're gonna make exceptions to that and make it so that real people can go to that as well.
it becomes a RIP party.
That's interesting.
You're a celebrity.
Way of phrasing it. Oh okay,
yeah,
that's fine then.
Yeah, I mean, people will have opportunities to attend that stuff, and you know, yeah, we'll have stuff planned all weekend. So mm-hmm. hopefully, you're there for the entire run. Mm-hmm. So, God, 8 weeks away. Probably it will be like 3 or 4 weeks away by the time this podcast goes out.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So we should sound even more anxious about it as we're saying this.
Yeah.
Yes, and I love how every time that there's a panel or anything, Allison Stroll, who is my boss, then when they don't know what to do, they're like, oh, yeah, we'll just have David go up there
and
talk.
David can just say stuff.
He'll talk.
Yeah. And
maybe not wet himself on
stage. Last I saw, I think you had like 48 panels or something that you were doing by yourself.
Should be exciting. The David Ellis Experience featuring David Ellis should be fantastic. So on that note, I think we've covered everything we're going to cover for this particular go-around. I think, Frank, you have to head out. And I should talk about – this is actually the first time we've actually recorded at 343.
In our soundproof recording space.
It's just kind of like a prison cell.
It is a lot like a – it's like a space prison cell. Like,
yeah. But we're more like a – probably keys. It's like an interrogation chamber with all these glass staring at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in a pleasant sort of way.
Yeah. Well, at least we have a light bulb now. There wasn't a light bulb earlier today.
It's not flickering, though. It should be flickering.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I have to thank Kathy, who's one of our PMs here, who kind of put furniture in.
She kind of messed up the ambiance with that light bulb.
Well, next time
you know what we need?
A
couple of ferns.
Between, two ferns.
Two ferns is the correct amount to make it feel at home.
Yeah, so once again, I mean, as we lead up to San Diego Comic-Con and Halo Fest, we'll be having a lot of information. We have Halo Bulletin, which we kicked off at E3, and that will be continuing. So every week, we'll be having more information out there as we lead up, and that's all on HaloWaypoint.com. You can hit us on Facebook as well. Halo 4, Halo Anniversary, lots of pages on Facebook, and of course, Halo Waypoint on Twitter. So until then, Max, thanks for joining us. We will definitely have to have you back on again. Maybe record something during Halo Fest.
Sure.
And for Frank and Dan, we'll see you next time.
Oh, should we pimp Crimson Alliance?
Oh, yeah. Well,
no,
Max is wearing his Crimson Alliance shirt.
Crimson Alliance. I can't even say the name of my own damn game.
You don't know what it's called.
I have one closing question for you. Did you remember to press the record button?
I did. Yes. Thank
good, because this is like the fifth time we've had to do
my
this
God.
Today.
But you know what? I think it's the best. This one's a keeper.
Excellent.
See you next time, guys.